This is The Guardian.
Hi everybody, Max here. This is not a note to say that the big news about Roman Abramovich happened after we finished recording. It didn't. It happened while we were recording. In fact, it happened at exactly the moment we were talking about Roman Abramovich. So we all took a pause. There's quite a sudden jump in part two, but we then do address the news that had just reached us about the sanctions for Roman Abramovich. We didn't know about Roman Abramovich when we were discussing the hilarious collapse of PSG, which is in part one. Here's the pod. Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. Lads, it's PSG going from virtual complete control to total capitulation in minutes. How does it keep happening? By the end, they were passing to Benzema. On a night where Kylian Mbappe shows his class and scores one of the coolest disallowed goals of all time, it ends up with the PSG president barging into a referee's office and asking for a free kick. They might be better off barging into Donnarumma's office and asking him what the hell he was doing. All in all, absolutely tremendous. Meanwhile, City had done their work in the first leg, but we'll assess if and when and how Pep will overthink the Champions League this year. Tell the legal department to turn off their phones and cancel their plans. Philippe is here for the first time to talk about sanctions, oligarchs, court cases, and presumably swear a lot. There's a Thursday night Premier League preview that will be out of date before you listen, and a weekend Premier League preview that you should be able to consume before the games actually happen. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Chromecast says this is definitely the best pod lineup, not necessarily as technical as your Wilsons or your Ronays, but definitely the best for vibes and general niceness. Barry Glendenning, welcome.
Hello, Max. Hi.
Philippe Auclair, hello.
Good morning to you.
And Lars Sivertsen, hello.
Good morning, Max. I think I will say, I cannot think of a, and I say this with some personal bias here, I can't think of a better post-PSG humiliation lineup. in terms of the people in the Guardian Football Weekly roster who are, you know, prepared to set their professionalism aside and be pretty clear about how they feel about PSG, I feel like the three people on the pod, you know, it's us.
Well, let's see if we can achieve it. Matthew says, can the first 5 minutes of the podcast just be Philippe laughing? Brian says, can the opening minutes of the pod just be Barry Glendenning laughing at PSG? Anshuman says, Lars, I want to hear you laughing the loudest, please. This is a request. Jay says, no questions, please. Can you all just laugh for one solid minute at PSG? Joachim tweeted on August the 11th, 2021 to say, how will Barry celebrate when PSG crash and burn out of this season's Champions League? And Jake says, is there a happier day of the year for Barry than when PSG exit the Champions League through one of their customary implosions? I imagine him opening him a fresh bottle of red, smoking a whole pack and chuckling while playing the Champions League theme on a loop. Barry, even by PSG standards, this was ridiculous.
I had a feeling I was going to struggle to get a word in edgeways today, and so it has come to pass already. Look, there isn't a whole lot going on in my life, Max, as you well know, but PSG getting knocked out of the Champions League certainly isn't an annual highlight, but it's remarkable, and it's not remarkable at all, really. It's another entirely predictable, gutless capitulation by a collection of, I suppose, ever-changing collection of unmanageable egomaniacs, divas and charlatans who represent a horrible club that's absolutely rotten from the top down. And you love to see it. In the past 9 years, they've blown apparently unassailable leads in the knockout stages on four different occasions. They've been walloped in quarterfinals by Barcelona, They've lost against City. They've been walloped by Real Madrid in the last 16. They've lost the only final they've got, and they lost the semi-final last season against Manchester City. Not all of them have been humiliating defeats, but cumulatively, for a team that is so hell-bent on winning this tournament and has invested so much money in trying to win this tournament, it is hugely embarrassing. And it's getting to the point where when they eventually do win it, which at some point you'd imagine they have to, but maybe not. no one will really care apart from, you know, just them. I really enjoyed this game. The collapse was predictable and comical.
How, Philippe, do you explain it? Because for 60 minutes, they weren't running the game completely, but they were good and they were controlled and they created chances and Mbappe was brilliant. And then, you know, the mistake by Donnarumma, and then they just sort of forget how to play. It was sort of England v Iceland type.
Yeah, very much so. But I think the capacity for meltdown is only commensurate to their sense of self-entitlement. And they're both linked. So the sense of entitlement goes with the moments where you start wondering whether at some point they do, oh, should we really feel so self-entitled? Are we really as good as we think we are and as people say we are? And then there's this moment, this fleeting moment when they lose, they start losing it. And when they start losing it, they carry on losing it and they lose it completely. The remontada by Barcelona, at least you would say Barcelona actually had a very decent team at the time and a couple of individualities who were on fire. And as well, they could turn. There was also some pretty dubious refereeing on that night. They really, everything went against them. This was quite different. Even though, and I'm sure we'll come to that, apparently, according to Leonardo Al-Halaifi and Pochettino, it's all the referee's fault. Because that goal should never, the one-all goal should never have stood, which is just pathetic. As Barry said, it's a collection of individualities. It's not Paris Saint-Germain, it's Panini Saint-Germain. It's like they collect players, like they collect NFTs. And yes, actually, it's actually not pictures of players, it's like NFTs because they're completely worthless. And then the result of that, you've got, then it becomes this big Moloch, this churning machine, which chews up great managers and spits them out. And once they've been spat out, they win the Champions League. It's become almost like a kind of initiation process for people who want to succeed. You first have got to go to, in the kind of success monopoly, you've got to go through the box of Paris Saint-Germain, get a lot of money for it, then get out of it and succeed. And no, as I agree with what Barry has said, it's completely rotten top to bottom, the culture of the club. There was a culture of the club, by the way, Max. You know, we shouldn't say that PSG is a pure invention of the Qataris. PSG was actually it's a young club, but a club which had actually acquired a very decent and fine history.
It had a soul.
And absolutely, completely. You know, I think of the PSG of Safet Susic, I think of the PSG of Rai. I think of this was a proper team and this was a proper club with proper support. Young, yes, but really something. They have managed to destroy that as well. It's extraordinary. It's extraordinary. I have no words apart from the fact I've just spoken for 10 minutes.
I'll go to Lars then. Tactically, did anything happen? I mean, Ancelotti made good substitutions.
He did.
And Modric obviously, you know, created the second goal kind of twice. But is it just a psychological thing, this? Or was there something that happened on the pitch tactically that changed this football match?
Yeah, so Ancelotti, another coach who's been booted out of PSG for not winning the Champions League, I guess. I think bringing on Camavinga was definitely the right call. He gave them a bit more energy than Kroos did, and given that they needed to push up, you know, that made sense. But I think you can't get away from the mental side of it, because just everything were so much in their favour. I completely agree that PSG is just a ludicrous construct. They're like they're the Kendall Roy's birthday party of football. You know, there's just too much going on, and it's just
that is for people who haven't seen. Just go and watch all of Succession from the start to get to Kendall Roy's birthday party to realize what a brilliant analogy that actually is.
Yeah, I'm very happy with it. Thank you very much. But it's also like one of the, there's so many expensive things that have been thrown at it, but it's just so crass. And anyway, even that being so, I think the first three halves of this game, of this tie, was pretty much as coherent and sensible as this team can get. Bearing in mind, you have to kind of carry three superstars off the ball. And as much as Pochettino is kind of being thrown to the wolves a little bit today, I think the way he set it up, I think the only way you can try to set this team up to make it work, and they, you know, they had the advantage, you know, there were two goals ahead in the tie. And Real Madrid, this sort of slightly aging, certainly in some departments, aging Real Madrid team, were in the unenviable position of having to push up, having to have a go, knowing that they have this phenomenal Kylian Mbappe, who for everything that's wrong with Paris Saint-Germain, I think he's really sort of shown over these two legs that, for me, the best player in the world. So you have to push up, knowing that you have this terribly good and fast guy who can kill you in any kind of counterattack. Like, tactically, it's the worst position to be in, which makes it even more spectacular that PSG managed to throw this situation away. It's absolutely unbelievable. And every goal they conceded was entirely self-inflicted. As much as we will praise Karim Benzema, and we should, and the third finish was, you know, really technically quite something. But all three goals were, like, you know, shooting yourself in both feet somehow. Like, it's just awful.
And the symbol of that is the fact that even Marquinhos, who is, I think we will all agree, an absolutely magnificent player, and who on so many occasions had been PSG's real boss on the field, he completely lost it. Which is really sad to happen to a player who's always, you know, you cannot put at his door the kind of doubts and actually a criticism that you would put at other players' doors. But it reminded me of what Thierry Henry was saying before the game. I don't know if you saw that, when he was talking about Neymar's state of mind at the moment. And he was actually being quite serious, and he said he was actually quite worried about some of these players, that they didn't look right in their heads. And I think it went beyond the I don't care, or we'll win anyway, or that there are some people who are having some pretty serious psychological problems there at PSG. Messi is obviously not well, not in his mind. He's still pining, I think. And Neymar looks completely lost. And it was a symbol, I think, when he loses the ball and Luka Modric takes it and then has this fabulous run. That was just magical.
Just to reiterate, like, he's 36. Like, we saw in the other game, we had this sort of Scott Carson was brought on for 20 minutes. And it was like, oh, look, it's Scott Carson. He's still alive. Who knew? You know, Scott Carson was born, like, 6 days before Luka Modric. There Luka Modric is. With the ball running faster than Neymar is running without the ball. I mean, that's remarkable. But also, yeah, like you said, Philippe, it's really weird. I also just think, I was about to say, let's be fair to PSG, we're not going to do that. But I just think the situation the club is in fundamentally is so daft. Because according to the latest reports from L'Équipe, almost 40% of all the wages that are being paid out in Ligue 1 are paid out by PSG. So you have a 20-team league where one team is paying out 40% of the salary. It's just a nonsense. Like, it's almost not sport anymore. It's completely ludicrous. And that means whatever happens in the league is kind of like, nah, it doesn't really matter.
They still managed to lose it.
The only thing that really matters for this club, every training session, every euro spent, all of it comes down to these knockout games in the Champions League. I don't think that's a healthy level of pressure for the players to have to cope with when the team is then completely dysfunctional as well. And of course, the chairman is... we'll get to that. But I mean, the behavior of the chairman post-match suggests that maybe, like, they're not coping very well with the situation off the pitch either.
Jay says, should PSG have kept Rabiot? You don't need to answer that question, Philippe. We should talk about Mbappe and Benzema, Barry, because, you know, they're at sort of two ends of their career kind of thing. But it was kind of... I don't know, my favourite part of all of their play was actually that dummy from Mbappe, which is just utterly heavenly, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's well, it isn't a shame the goal was disallowed, but what a piece of skill. He's clearly a wonderful player. I'm not sure what else you want me to say. So is Karim Benzema. And you've done it to me again, Max.
I just wanted you to feel included, Barry. That was all. You don't have
If I could address the point of PSG's game management, I mean, they have very experienced players. They're, you know, in the box seat. Why did no one take Luka Modric down when he went on that gallop upfield for their second goal? Why did no PSG, you know, when it became apparent everything was falling apart, why did no one just go down with an injury and just pause the game for a while? It just seems, for players of such huge experience, it seems very naive. But I don't know. I'm advocating gamesmanship and foul play, which of course it shouldn't be, but that's the nature of the game. I was watching that second goal over and over again, and I go, why did no one just foul Modric?
I wonder if some of their players missed the third goal. I mean, I missed the third goal. I was just sort of looking around, getting ready for, you know, the game to restart, give myself a few seconds, and they'd scored again. And like that Marquinhos clearance is so weird. Like you say, he's a wonderful footballer, but what is that? That's complete, Matt. You know, like they were just, you know, you don't like, I think Glenn Hoddle said, you know, this is schoolboy football, but schoolboys who've never played football before, you know, that is just a really bizarre thing. I know the game is going really quickly and you can't compare it to Sunday football, but that is Sunday football. So I have just compared it. Does Poch survive this? Sorry.
No. I was going to say, no, it doesn't survive this. And there's one thing we should add, just to add to the Schadenfreude, is of course that this year's final was to be played at the Stade de France. Ouch. That hurts.
Yeah.
But for Poch, in France, everybody thinks that he's gone and he will go. I'm just wondering if PSG might sack him before the end of the season so that he can't even claim to have a French champion title, because I can't even see, not even this PSG team being able to lose a 13-point, I think, lead over the rest. But this said, Max, we saw strange portents of what happened against Real Madrid in the French League against Nice over the weekend. They were absolutely appalling, and they were missing a Hakimi and Mbappe. So two of their better players, well, their best player and one of their better players. But there were also signs that they didn't quite know what to do. They were outplayed by Nice, which is, you know, worrying. And I thought, maybe, you know, it's the nerves before Real Madrid, and then you have confirmation. So I think Pochettino, many people were expecting him to leave during the summer, Max, because of his relationship with Leonardo, which is not very good, to say the least. He stayed, but now, yes, everybody thinks and knows he will be gone by the end of the season.
So do we think, Lars, that Zidane goes to PSG? And if Zidane does go to PSG, is he the person that can turn this club into a club at a different football club? And does Pochettino go to Manchester United? Or do Manchester United look at this and go, we can't have someone who hasn't won anything? And, you know, because that would just, you can just see what will happen when Pochettino goes to Manchester United.
So the Zidane thing is, on the one hand, from a football point of view, it makes a ton of sense, right? Because you have this club who don't want to build a team in a rational and sensible way. They just want to sign big stars. So they need someone who can sort of be the ego whisperer and mold that group into something that kind of works. I don't know how this current front three can ever work, really, with the sort of no running the front three thing, but it makes sense from that point of view. But the thing that I guess we kind of forget, because we're not French, except Philippe, who is that, I mean, Zidane is a Marseille boy, you know? He's, I mean, he's huge. He's a Marseille guy. And I wonder, it would be an extraordinary betrayal for him to take over Paris Saint-Germain, even if this construct that the Qatari Paris Saint-Germain team is kind of has very little to do with Paris culturally. But I still think that would be strange, right, Philippe?
It would be very, very strange. He's been approached a number of times. He's always said no. And very wisely, I think. I mean, the wildest rumor that did the rounds not that long ago was that he would be joined as a director by Arsene Wenger as a director of football, which...
Oh, my God.
Yes. And I mean, of course, Wenger has got links with PSG, but he's got links with the older PSG, which is of the Colony Capital era. But he's also got links with beIN Sport, obviously. And as we know, beIN Sport is Nasser Al-Khelaifi, who is also PSG for the time being. And so, yes, it's done the rounds. And at one point, people were, you know, quite sure it was going to happen. As a manager, you'd have to be completely mad to go there, unless you can have Leonardo out, first thing to do, and a change at the top of the club as well, and Nasser Al-Khelaifi goes as well.
Just moving it on slightly, Greg Jenner, friend of the pod, the historian, said, is Poch Spursy through contamination, or is PSG simply Spursy in their own right? Can we talk about Nasser Al-Khelaifi and Leonardo going into the referee's room? Apparently, they stormed the referee's dressing room, broke equipment after the game, according to the referee's report, verified by multiple reports, including ESPN. Quote, behaved aggressively, tried to enter the referee's dressing room. When the referee asked them to leave, the president hit a piece of the assistant's equipment, breaking it. I mean, you hope he got a flag and broke it angrily on his knee. But like, that is, I mean, if that happened, that is utterly ridiculous.
And Max, apparently, according to some other Spanish media and the better ones, Cadena Cope apparently has got pictures of Nasser Al-Khelaifi actually threatening an employee of Real Madrid. Apparently this was filmed. So that could actually have got serious repercussions because Leonardo, for example, that's not the first time he completely loses it. He's got a history of that. But again, it goes with this sense of self-entitlement. I mean, to have... Honestly, to say that the loss is to be blamed on the referees, I mean, it's insanity, isn't it? Or is it just me? I mean, it's insane.
I would argue that it kind of sums up the reason why PSG loses these games. Because that decision, you've seen them given, to be fair. But the point is that once they concede that goal, they're still ahead in the tie. They're still ahead in the tie against a team that they've looked stronger than. They still have, again, the best player in the world who's especially good at attacking into space. So tactically, the thing still favors you so heavily. But they completely lost their heads. And for the club chairman to react to that defeat, for the club, sorry, the club president, to react to that defeat, not by looking at, oh my God, we have to completely change the mentality of this club so that this doesn't happen. That's not his reaction. His reaction is to harass the referee. What could possibly sum up the utter dysfunction, entitlement, and nonsense of this club better than that, if indeed it happened?
Ben says, did the pod think Ancelotti regrets leaving Everton? And Chris says, thoughts on David Alaba bringing some seated furniture to a celebration and not smacking the life out of it? Yes, it was nice to see him with the chair, but he didn't go full Weatherspoons.
Does it mean anything, Max? Have you found out if it's a gesture that means anything to brandish a white plastic chair?
He tweeted something after... I suspect it was just the nearest thing to hand, but he tweeted something after the game, something along the lines of, don't you dare sit in our chair, or something like that, you know, a message to PSG.
Well, I just think he likes that video of me dancing while the racing's on. any more to add on this match before we...
I think... Sing the praises of the great Karim Benzema is indispensable, and we will never sing his praises enough because they haven't been sung enough in the past. It's just gone past Don Alfredo Di Stefano in the list of all-time Real Madrid goal scorers. This is something which is enormous, huge. And also, I have to say, I've rarely seen a player as exuding, exulting with pure joy as after his third goal. I thought this was one of the most beautiful things I've seen for a very long time on a football pitch. This was just pure joy, elation. And also, it was not a look-at-me kind of elation. It was a proper footballer's elation. He's just magnificent. The way he's been able to, you know, when you know about the problems he's had, and some of them were of his own making, probably. But what he's managed to become late in his career is simply worthy of admiration. And he's one of the all-time great number nines. He's the greatest number nine France has ever had. That's without a doubt. And he's one of the greatest, perhaps the greatest number nine after Cristiano Ronaldo, if I can mention his name, that Real Madrid has ever had, which means he must be pretty high in the list of all-time great number nines. So, yeah, chapeau, Karim. Absolutely magnificent. Go, Karim, go.
That'll do for part one. Part two, we'll begin at the Etihad. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Anne Schumann's second question to the pod. Can anyone say with any conviction that Man City Sporting actually happened? What a game this was, Baz.
I can say it actually happened because I think I was probably the only person in Europe who watched every single minute of it because I was very kindly given the job of doing the online report, which meant I watched the PSG or the Real Madrid PSG game afterwards, knowing the outcome, which was a bit of a bummer. But yeah, the game happened. It wasn't particularly eventful. Both teams would be happy with the results. Sporting, you know, it was a foregone conclusion. Sporting were 5-0 down going into the second leg. But they got some pride back with a decent performance, kept a clean sheet. Manchester City got to blood some youngsters. Conrad Egan-Riley started at right back for them. That was his first Champions League appearance. Luke Mbete and James McAtee came on and made their Champions League appearances. Highlight of the game for me was Scott Carson coming on halfway through the second half and immediately being pressed into action and making a splendid save. And it looked like he might have to go off about 15 seconds after he'd come on, which would have been a shame for him. But he managed to carry on. I suppose the other talking points were the Sporting right back, Pedro Porro, has been a Manchester City player for 2.5 seasons, or 2.5 years. But this was the first time he ever played at the Etihad. He has yet to meet Pep Guardiola. And at one point last night, he gave the ball away cheaply. I was thinking, yeah, that's probably not the impression you want to make on your possibly future boss. And then during the second half, Sporting brought on a young lad called Marcus Edwards. He's from Enfield, went through the Spurs Academy, and then went to play in Portugal, possibly Spain first, then Portugal. And he really made a big impression on me. He was very good when he came on. And it was his introduction that Sporting really got stuck into City. But at that point, it was obviously far too late and they were never, ever going to turn this around. And a tip of the hat to Sporting's travelling support, who really tried to turn what was quite a drab affair into a very special occasion. They didn't stop chanting, singing all night, and put their home-based counterparts to shame.
Thank you, Barry. Paul says, I've been dying for Philippe to be on the pod for a few weeks now. Tell us what to do, monsieur. Hashtag Philippe for global leader. So I do want to ask you, Philippe, we've obviously talked about it on the pod, but we haven't talked about it with you, about Roman Abramovich and Chelsea and him having to sell the club. This week we learnt that the British property tycoon Nick Candy, who is most famous, of course, for marrying Holly Valance from Neighbours, is trying to build a consortium capable of rivaling Bowley and Weiss's group bid, if I've pronounced their names correctly. The New York Jets owner, Woody Johnson's also being talked about as a potential bidder. He was known in London as Donald Trump's ambassador to the UK, so that's good. It is thought unlikely that Abramovich would be allowed to sell Chelsea if sanctions were imposed on him. Interested parties have been given until the 15th of March to submit bids. It has been reported that Abramovich, who's faced calls in Parliament for him to be sanctioned since the invasion of Ukraine, is looking for as much as $4 billion. I just wonder, Philippe, how you view Abramovich's tenure as owner of Chelsea. If people have...
Thanks a lot. That's okay.
We're not yeah. live. If people have done enough to expose his links to Putin, those links which he vehemently denies, I'll be reading out a few statements, obviously.
Well, were all the photographs showing him in great conversation with Vladimir Putin photoshopped?
No. Well, probably not.
Probably not. Was he a governor of the province of Chukotka?
This sounds like this is my worst mastermind special subject.
We've got to be very careful, and part of the problem is that we've got to be very careful. I think what's happening with the Chelsea case is, in a way, shows what's happening in this country as a whole, is that everybody's talking about sanctions. Everybody's talking about this and this and that and the need to be strong. And whilst other countries are taking very strong sanctions, nothing is happening here.
Hi, everybody. Sorry for the sort of random cut in the middle of the pod. Everyone is still here. But about a minute after Philippe stopped talking, we saw a tweet from Miguel Delaney saying Roman Abramovich has been sanctioned. Obviously, we stopped because we were quite surprised. This is an extract from the statement issued by the government. The consolidated list of financial sanctions targets in the UK. I will read it to you. It says, Roman Abramovich is a prominent Russian businessman and pro-Kremlin oligarch. Abramovich is associated with a person who is or has been involved in destabilizing Ukraine and undermining and threatening the territorial integrity, sovereignty, and independence of Ukraine, namely Vladimir Putin, with whom Abramovich has had a close relationship for decades. This association has included obtaining a financial benefit or other material benefit from Putin and the government of Russia. This includes tax breaks received by companies linked to Abramovich, buying and selling shares from and to the state at favorable rates, and the contracts received in the run-up to the FIFA 2018 World Cup. Therefore, Abramovich has received preferential treatment and concessions from Putin and the government of Russia. And a bit more from the government. Those newly sanctioned by the UK include Roman Abramovich, owner of Chelsea Football Club, worth more than £9 billion. A further group of Russia-based oligarchs close to Putin have also been placed under sanction. Martin Ziegler from The Times says, Roman Abramovich sanctioned, all UK assets frozen. Chelsea can still operate under a special license, but sale now on hold. Club will not be allowed to sell any more tickets. Only season ticket holders can go to games for the foreseeable future. Miguel Delaney also tweeting, this bars the sale of the club. I mean, this, Philippe, is extraordinary, isn't it?
What can I possibly say? Maybe someday listeners of the pod will hear what we were talking about when we suddenly got this breaking news, but it came as a big surprise to us. What I would say is amen to that. The right decision obviously has been taken. I think it's also a vindication of what a number of very brave people have been saying for quite a while. I'm thinking here of Catherine Belton, the author of Putin's People, and a publisher, HarperCollins. Buy it. And many people have been trying to say this for a long, long time and haven't been able to do so because of our legal system and so forth. I think it's a watershed, honestly, because when you hit at Roman Abramovich, you're hitting at probably the most, inverted commas, acceptable, you know, face of Russian presence in the UK, because he has transformed this club. It's made it into this amazing title-winning machine. So it means this is things are to be taken seriously. And as to the consequences on the club, I'm sure we'll get back to that. But my goodness, I think there's so much to process, Max, that I think perhaps apart from saying amen to that and taking stock of what's being said, I think maybe we should take a seat back and think for a while and see what happens, because it will have an absolutely astonishing effect on the club and on the team and on everything. And I hope beyond that, if we are able to take measures of that kind against against Mr. Abramovich and therefore Chelsea, perhaps look at other clubs which operate in this country, which also have links to people who are not much better than Mr. Abramovich.
They'll be sweating on Tyneside at this news.
Well, this is kind of obviously a breaking story, so none of us have had a chance to sort of make any inquiries about what this actually means beyond what's right in front of us. But I see that Stephen Swinford, the political editor of The Times, is tweeting that the government would need to give special dispensation for the sale of Chelsea, and no money could go to Abramovich, either directly or indirectly. Abramovich, will not get a penny from the sale of the club. So that obviously is quite dramatic if that stands. One would imagine that Mr. Abramovich will try to challenge it somehow. But it's quite dramatic. And in terms of what it actually means for Chelsea, I mean, over the years, Abramovich have put just incredible sums into the club. I mean, we remember the initial splurge, of course. The vision was always that they were going to be self-sufficient. I remember Peter Kenyon talking about it back in 2008, that like in a couple of years, this club will be paying for itself. But that never came to pass. I mean, friend of the show, Kieran O'Connor at Swiss Ramble on Twitter, has made a handy sort of graph showing the amount of annual sort of Abramovich funding that's gone into the club. And since he came in 2003, 2004, only two seasons has there not been a significant amount of money put in by Abramovich to make ends meet. So Chelsea, as successful as they have been, and they've been good at, for instance, making money through player sales, they have a really, really good academy, all this sort of stuff, they've not been able to pay for themselves during this period of success. So if with whatever these sanctions mean, I think it's fair to say it means no more money from Abramovich, right? So they're going to have to smarten up real fast in terms of how to be successful while spending less money than they've been used to.
Opposition fans will obviously, you know, schadenfreude, they'll laugh at Chelsea and they'll say, oh, you know, this is it for you. But isn't the real story that what we want is a club as famous with as proud a history as Chelsea, even if it wasn't trophy winning as much as the Abramovich years? You know, the good to come out of it is fans to own this club, fans to own every, you know, like to manage your expectations again, but to come up with a club that does sustain itself and can have success, perhaps in a different way, perhaps not of such a higher level, but you know, means something to those supporters.
Well, it means a lot now. And you could say that the club had been trying to change its model for a while with its youth policy and so forth. And, you know, we shouldn't talk as if Chelsea Football Club was gone as of now. I'm just trying to get my head around all the various ramifications of this decision, because what does it mean in terms of paying wages? What does it mean in terms of transfers? And because you would have to know exactly what the economic structure of Chelsea Football Club is and the way that the company operates to have. But I can only imagine the impact will be absolutely massive, and possibly, you know. Just as Roman Abramovich's arrival in June 2003 had a transformative impact on Chelsea Football Club, what's happened today will have a transformative effect on Chelsea Football Club, but the other way around. It's very difficult to see how it could be otherwise.
I think a lot of this will come out in the next couple of days, and by Monday's pod, we'll have a kind of this is what it means type conversation. But I think ultimately, and I know you and I have talked about this, Barry, when we talk about, you know, I think when we talked about the Saudi ownership of Newcastle and how I think we both agree we would walk away if that was our club. Easy to say when it isn't your club. What you want is for fans to be able to have a club that is clean. And it doesn't really matter what division it's in, right? And it must be, maybe it's hard if you've won loads of stuff. But actually what your club is for, it's a community thing that you love going to, not because they're winning or losing or whatever, just because it's part of your routine. It's passed down through families. That's what Chelsea should be, like every football club should be.
Yeah, I agree. But lots of people aren't of a similar view and are only interested in success. And I'd imagine if Chelsea suddenly found themselves in the conference, that their attendances would drop very dramatically.
Rob Draper tweeting from the Mail on Sunday, I'm wondering if any Chelsea fans now regret chanting the name of Abramovich during a period of support for Ukraine. Now it's spelt out in black and white. Might as well have chanted Vladimir Putin. Or do they just double down and insist it's all a conspiracy to take down Chelsea? I guess at this stage, I should probably say it is important to note that Abramovich has vehemently and repeatedly denied having access to, favour with, or any special relationship with Putin or the Kremlin. Abramovich also denies that he was motivated in any way by Putin to buy Chelsea FC. He denies that his ownership of the club has anything to do with soft power or political ends. Also worth noting that Chelsea tweeted at about exactly the moment that Roman Abramovich was sanctioned. Norwich Chelsea tonight, come on Chelsea, mocked up Thomas Tuchel as sort of Alan Partridge style radio DJ holding a mug saying champions of the world, Norwich Chelsea, with a Thomas Tuchel smile. As you tweeted, Lars, not now, admin.
There's a time and a place for Partridge, and this isn't it.
Is there anything else anybody wants to add? I appreciate we're all sort of dealing with this news as it's coming in. So, you know, this is live, you know, for the first time ever, some news has broken while we're doing the pod and not afterwards.
The only thing I'd add is I'm absolutely astonished this has happened. I didn't think the government had it in them to do this. I was saying that just as the news broke in what will prove to be an excellent offcut, hopefully, for a live show sometime. But my mind is well and truly boggled. I didn't think they would sanction him until after he'd sold his London homes and his football club.
Yeah, we are about to announce a live tour in June and July going around the UK. May I suggest it is worth buying a ticket just for the timing of the clip, which is not fair on Barry, because I agreed with pretty much every word you said, but I didn't say it. But you'll get to hear that.
Unless, of course, we get sanctioned, in which case we won't be able to sell
That's
tickets.
That's a very good point. If The Guardian gets sanctioned, then really there is a long, long list of people, aren't there? Right, that'll do then for part two. Part three, we'll look ahead to the Premier League weekend. Hello, everybody. Max again. We should say that after we finished recording, Chelsea released a statement confirming they had been advised of sanctions made by the UK government. They said, quote, by virtue of his 100% ownership of Chelsea FC PLC and affiliated entities, Chelsea FC would normally be subject to the same sanctions regime as Mr. Abramovich. However, the UK government has issued a general license that permits Chelsea FC to continue certain activities. They went on to confirm that they will fulfil their men's and women's team fixtures today against Norwich and West Ham, respectively, and said that they, quote, intend to engage in discussions with the UK government regarding the scope of the licence. This will include seeking permission for the licence to be amended in order to allow the club to operate as normal as possible. They said they will update further when it's appropriate to do so. We'll be back after this.
Hello, Guardian columnist Jonathan Friedland here. I now have my own US politics podcast, which is, helpfully, called Politics Weekly America. So if you want to hear my interviews with politicians like Hillary Clinton or expert analysis from Guardian journalists and the latest news from Washington, D.C. and beyond, you should subscribe. To do that, just type Politics Weekly America into Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be there every Friday.
Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Before we look ahead to the Premier League games tonight and at the weekend, Philippe, you wanted to chapeau to Lyon.
I wanted to doff my beret to Lyon, who won 1-0 in Porto thanks to an absolutely beautiful goal by the very underrated, very cheap Lucas Paqueta, the Brazilian number 8 or 8.5, after an absolutely superb backheel by Moussa Dembélé. It's a real exploit. It's a victory that nobody saw coming from Lyon in Porto, which confirms French clubs remarkable season in European competition so far, with the exception of the Qatari branch of French football, which, you know, we've talked a long time about. But the others are doing extremely well. And Lyon is a symbol of this renaissance of Ligue 1 on the European stage.
Lars?
I want to tip my hat to the Seattle Sounders, New York City FC, and the New England Revolution, who all won their first legs in the quarterfinals of the CONCACAF Champions League last night, a competition where MLS clubs have historically struggled to make an impact. But with three MLS teams looking good to go through to the semifinals, maybe finally a team not from the Mexican League will win the CONCACAF Champions League, or maybe they will win and mess it up at the end, as they always do. We will see. Exciting times there anyway.
Well, tonight, Chelsea go to Norwich. You can imagine that the Norwich fans will have some things to sing at this ground. I mean, that is it'd be fascinating to see what that atmosphere would be like. But I presume Norwich fans will sing, "You're going down with the Norwich." I mean, that's what I would probably sing if I was a Norwich fan. Southampton play Newcastle, Wolves, Watford, Leeds, Villa. I'm guessing most people will listen to this pod after those games happen. But, you know, if anybody wants to talk about any of those specifically, they can. Saturday, there are three matches: Brighton, Liverpool, Brentford, Burnley, which is a big game at the bottom of the table. And Spurs continue their tour of crisis clubs as they go to Old Trafford. It's also in the knowledge that as soon as they lose, they become the crisis club. It's like crisis club it, isn't it? They just tag them. So fascinating to see who wins out of Manchester United and Spurs. And then six games on Sunday. By Sunday, when Chelsea play Newcastle, will Chelsea fans sing "It's Gonna Happen to You" to Newcastle fans? I don't know how quickly this comes around. Everton, Wolves, Leeds, Norwich, Southampton, Watford, West Ham, Villa and Arsenal, Leicester all on Sunday. It's a lot of games on a Sunday, isn't it? Palace City's on Monday. Matt says, what should John Terry invest in next? I mean, not Chelsea, I presume. This is Joey Durso in The Athletic saying John Terry's collection of NFTs have plummeted in value by 90% over the past month. Tammy Abraham, Ashley Cole quietly deleted their endorsements of the controversial scheme. Terry's Ape Kids Football Club NFTs were publicly trading for an average price of $656 after their launch on the 2nd of February. By March the 8th, the average price had dropped to $65. Actually, interestingly, Philippe, this is moving into sanctions and war more than football, but after that cryptocurrency special where we were being told about the absolute benefits of a unregulated currency in Bitcoin, the fact that a currency can be completely unregulated does have implications in the sense that you can't regulate it when you want to sanction a country.
Correct. And the response, by the way, from the Crypto Brothers community to the idea of imposing sanctions and preventing assets, crypto assets being moved by Russian interest was very, very indicative of actually what their priorities are, which is basically just making money. And they said that, I'm concentrating everything they said in a couple of sentences, but it was against the ethos and the very basic principles which found cryptocurrency to impose sanction and to which, of course, the principles of anonymity and so forth. So it is quite extraordinary that people who are constantly championing transparency, level playing field, democracy, honesty, are actually willing to facilitate the transfer of assets by criminals and criminal powers. Well done, guys.
Thank you to a standard socialist bringing us back to football, sending me a remarkable set of results from the Highland League. Deverendale 0, Fraserburgh 6. Forres Mechanics 0, Brora Rangers 8. Fort William 0, Nairn County 4. Keith 0, Bucky Thistle 6. Rothers 0, Brecon City 1. So Brecon letting the side down, but 0 home goals in the Highland League and 10, 18, 20, 25 away goals. So that's, home advantage counts for nothing in the Highland League. Rahul says, Philippe, what cheese do you prefer eating during lunch? Because I've heard and read that French people do that during meals.
During lunch?
No, after
before lunch. Before the dessert? I would say at lunch, I would go for maybe a Comté, like an aged, like 36-month-old Comté. Here in Britain, I would go perhaps for a little bit of a Stinking Bishop, delicious, and a bit of blue as well. So could be Roquefort, could be Gorgonzola, it could be Stilton, you know. So there you have a nice plate of cheese with a bit of Queen's jelly on the side, some fresh grapes, a glass of Brie, and ooh la la. I'm feeling hungry now. It's only 9:49 London time. I blame it on you.
I am guilty, but I'm guilty of making the pod start early. Other people discussed in this pod, perhaps guilty of more serious things, and maybe that's where we'll leave it today. Barry, thank you, mate.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Philippe.
Thank you very much, Max. It might be a busy day ahead.
It may be. Thank you, Lars.
Thank you, Max. I was worried we wouldn't have enough to talk about today to fill the time, but, you know, turned out to be okay.
Things happen. We'll be back on Monday. I mean, presumably, Faye Carruthers will be here on Monday, unless, you know, it's a phantom pregnancy. Who knows? But The Guardian Football Weekly will be here on Monday. Today's episode was produced by Joel Grove. Good luck, Joel. It was exec produced by Max Arneson. Good luck, Max. And it was lawyered by lawyers. We'll be back on Monday.
This is The Guardian.